even during the difficult periods of the Roman occupation of Palestine, the Romans, for the most part, did not interfere with the internal structure of Jewish ethics. There were exceptions, but the Romans respected such mystical sects as the Essenes, protected them, favored them, and excused them from military service and other practices common to the Roman state. In North Africa, the Romans tolerated the Gnostics and the Neoplatonists and the Neopythagoreans. We may say, generally speaking, that the Romans were interested in only two essential restrictions upon the lives of the people. The first, that the private citizen keep out of politics, and second, that he paid his taxes. With these two decisions in his favor, he had a great deal of personal freedom. After the fall, however, of the Roman Empire, conditions became rapidly worse on the level of scholarship. Obviously, the circumstances contributing to the decline and fall of Rome fill the region and time with chaos. There was very little opportunity for the advancement of any positive cultural system. Human beings were fighting for existence, and for the most part were bitterly disillusioned, not only with their temporal leadership, but with the religion which they had previously known. Out of this general chaos arose the beginnings of the Holy Roman Empire. Christendom became, in time, the dominating religious force of the Mediterranean area. At this time also, Christendom, which had gone through a very difficult time, began to sense the possibility not only of spiritual but temporal leadership in European affairs. As a result, gradually the Anti-Nicene fathers, who were mostly apologists, gave way to the post-Nicene followers and fathers, who were mostly militant exponents of their doctrines. This meant that the remnants of the old philosophic empire lost all possibility of survival in Europe, at least for the present. The only way to escape the spreading animosity of the new religion was to depart into the desert. And first in the more remote cities, then in small towns, and finally in villages, the remnants of the old doctrines held their own, in some cases for centuries, very largely through vigilance and secrecy. When we consider the situation in the Near East, we have to realize, therefore, that into it flowed the best of the knowledge of the time. Here, the caliphs of Baghdad had a great interest in and tolerance for the learning Europe was discarding. They welcomed the mathematicians and the post-Pythagoreans into their fraternity of learning. They also were quick to pick up the scientists that had been scattered by the changing climate in Europe. They had a great affinity for the poets, for literature, and for the old wisdom of the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Persians and many other peoples. Also into this same, at first we might call it a hodgepodge of factors, a number of Christian groups also took refuge. So the church began to get more temporal authority. It demanded conformity. And almost immediately, it developed heretics. One of the earliest and most powerful of these heresies was the Nestorian. Another, almost equally positive and widespread, was the Manichaean. Both of these groups, essentially Christian in their point of view, certainly heavily influenced by the rising tide of Christian mysticism, both of these groups were anathematized, cast out of Christendom, and forced to flee for existence. The Near East became the sanctuary, therefore, for Christian nonconformists as well as pagans. The Christian nonconformists had quite a problem on their hands in many instances. They traveled very far to escape some form of intolerance. The Nestorians took refuge in China. It is also known that Jewish mystical sects were forced to flee. And in the course of the early centuries, under both Christian and later Muslim persecution, we know they reached China, India, Tibet. And according to an account which I recently heard, they even reached Japan at the beginning of the Christian era. In any event, there was a scattering of learning. There was a diaspora which included not only one sect or one group, but many different lines of belief. We learn also from contemporary records in Arabia at that time that the problem of who was right in religion gained almost the importance that we face today in trying to decide whether Johnson is better than Goldwater. The problem of religion was on the lips of every man in Damascus, in Baghdad, in Basra, and other centers where these religious groups mingled in such strange confusion. Caravan drivers were talking about the Holy Trinity. Merchants were arguing about the Immaculate Conception. And individuals whom you might regard as little better than tradesmen were attempting the quadrature of the circle and the triangulation of the right angle, or the trisection of the right angle. Astronomy, mathematics, medicine, optics. These suddenly became the concerns and interests of common, so-called proletarian groups. The Near East was aflame with inquiry, with intellectual curiosity on almost every conceivable subject. And always there were exiles, heretics, individuals who had escaped, maybe only with their lives, leaving all their worldly goods behind, who were willing to open schools on the steps of mosques or in some oasis in the desert and teach these hungry people all that they had brought with them from the lost culture of the Mediterranean. This was a very interesting time, a very important period in the structure of Near Eastern mystical tradition. Underneath practically every system that escaped into the desert, there were mystical factors. The Greek rites, the great ceremonial initiations of the Dionysian and Eleusinian rites were represented in the Near East. The deeper mysteries of Kabbalism found root there. Some of the best Kabbalists produced were among the Arabs. Alchemy found a footing. Magic, all kinds of seership, abstract speculations about the structure of the universe, astronomy, and all these phases of learning, anatomy, physiology, biology, medicine. were developing very rapidly among the Arabs and the Persians. It is interesting to realize this because it was the departure of practically all learning from Europe that led to the terrible misfortune that we call the Dark Ages. And it was not until this same learning by devious route finally came back to Europe through the Moorish universities of Spain that this dark veil upon the minds of men was finally lifted again. Aristotle and Plato reached medieval Europe by way of Arabia, not by a direct descent to Greece and Rome. When this new learning appeared, incidentally, in Europe, it found a rather rapid acceptance. By this time, centuries had passed. The Dark Ages had frightened man, had filled the European with a strange uneasiness and distrust. He had already felt the terrible weight of superstition upon him. He had gone through these awful experiences of fear, the belief in the end of the world, the parades and processions of penitents marching about Europe, leaving their bodies on every roadside. It was a very unhappy time. So the universities were rather quick to accept back again the lost heritage of the Greeks and the Latins and the Egyptians, even though it did in some measure conflict with the rising power of Christendom. After all, Christendom also had passed through a very difficult time, and actually the Christian Church was nothing but people, and these people, as their needs changed, were forced to acknowledge the demand for enlightenment. But to go back to the Near East, where our problem principally rests, we find that just as surely as physics became important, metaphysics likewise was sensed as a valid way of study. The Muslim, although rather conservative in his religious thinking, never built the powerful barriers against scientific and rational progress that some of the religions unfortunately built about them. He was therefore able to accept a great deal of knowledge without turning and directly persecuting the sources of knowledge. At the same time, under the caliphs, the faith of Islam was developing a strong orthodoxy. What had been almost a spiritual motion among the Arabic people began to take on the formal appearance of an extreme sectarianism. Thus, the orthodox Muslim almost reached the point where he was inclined to cast out heretics, and the old patterns repeated themselves to some degree. But the Arab was a much more subtle person than the European. He found different ways of perpetuating his convictions and beliefs. A mysticism did arise in Christianity, and this mysticism ultimately became completely accepted as long as it was within the structure of the church. A mysticism also arose in Arabia, and this likewise was accepted as long as it was held within the boundaries of the Muslim law. Also, by nature of his peculiar emotionalism, the Near Easterner had a great love for the pomp and circumstance of mystical ritual and for the strange nocturnal assemblies of saints and sages. It was rather picturesque, and he was deeply affected by these traditions and these practices that had come to him from another region. By degrees, the best of Islam was associated with its mystical orders. And in these orders can be traced most of the religions of the time. For the Near East was also in the crossroads between Europe and Asia. The traffic from Europe to the Near East was far heavier than the traffic in the opposite direction. But in the relations of Islam to the Far East, there was a continuous two-way traffic. So finally, in this mysterious melting pot of metaphysics, the Near East, we find Mediterranean culture, Far Eastern culture, brought together to form one of the most interesting basic patterns that we know. There's probably no other group in the world that has had so many influences operating upon it, has accepted into its structure so many concepts derived from different sources as the dervishes and the Sufis of Islam. Here we find the Buddhist doctrines, the Hindu beliefs, the ancient Avestan concepts. We find everything from Siberian shamanism to North African Gnosticism. One of the interesting points, it seems, is that all of these different borrowings, when lumped and heaped together, should prove compatible. This, I think, the Arabs were rather quick to notice. They suddenly realized that while the outer bodies of sects were constantly warring, the deeper parts of the doctrines were in conformity. Each contributed something to the general advancement of man's insight. All nations, all peoples had ultimately come to the conclusion that man's search for truth must be a personal, internal experience. That it is not possible for him to find the ultimates that he seeks in institutions of any kind. No matter how many study together, each man must walk the road to enlightenment alone. He may be encouraged, he may be helped, but in the end, he must explore with his own consciousness alone those mysteries which are necessary in order that he may answer the eternal questions that human beings have asked from the beginning. The Persian mystics and the Muslim saints, therefore, sensed very quickly the need for a kind of an invisible fraternity. They perhaps gained part of this very concept itself from some of the secret groups of the Near East that had preceded them, or the Mediterranean, especially perhaps the Pythagorean school, whose scattered adepts still had some kind of contact with each other. Out of all of this came a very loosely organized fraternity, a fraternity of persons, many of whom never actually met each other bodily, but were in some kind of internal communion. Part of the Sufi doctrine is extremely reminiscent of Taoism and Zen. It is a perpetuation without oral instruction. It was the belief that men had certain intuitive powers, that they could extend their consciousness to a union, that without speaking, men might commune with the saints, and the saints, though not visible, could bestow their benedictions and their instructions upon men. The saints of Islam are very much like the Rishi of India, or the Arhats of Buddhism, strange, mysterious beings whose long shadow returned to Europe in the form of the alchemical adepts, those who possessed the secrets of secrets and wandered unknown along the roads of Europe, visiting one town after another, bestowing their blessings and their insight upon the honest chemists they met along the way. Alchemy was flourishing, not only in Arabia, but in China and in India. All these old mystical psychological systems were operating in the vast area which we call the deserts of Arabia, Yemen, and the Najd. The mere fact that Islam had achieved a certain orthodoxy only perhaps added to this mystical importance. Even in the Quran, and certainly in the apocryphal writings of Islam, there is much to suggest that Muhammad himself was not only a mystic, but was in communication with other mystics. That perhaps even he belonged to this elusive order of semi-human, semi-divine teachers who corresponded to the great Mahatman Yoga and yogis of India. So we have the gradual growth of an invisible empire. No one questioned its existence. No one perhaps quite knew where it was. Everyone believed in it and defended it, but could not swear that a member had ever been seen, or anything distinct or definite was actually known about these green-robed teachers who could materialize and dematerialize at will, like the mysterious alchemical adepts of Korea and China. But there was this belief in an invisible empire of the enlightened. To this empire belonged the great axis of the Dervish order himself. It could never be seen by mortals except at the Feast of Ramadan, when he was seated for a few moments upon the roof of the Kaaba at Mecca. All these legends and stories gained authority not so much through any physical relations between people as the result of these inner mystical trances. Mysticism opened up the inner life of the Muslim, giving him new keys with which to interpret the secrets of the Quran, a new wonder for the mysterious night journey of the Prophet Muhammad through the gates of the seven parts of the universe into the presence of the eternal God. All these, the matters were constantly considered, and they were meditated upon by the pious and by those who were seeking to understand the mysterious universal key to all knowledge, the concept of which they had inherited from Egypt, Greece, and Rome. In the midst of this, we can point out the personality of Omar Khayyam. He flourished in the 12th century. We like to think of him sometimes as Omar the Tent Maker. Perhaps he was better known in his own time as Omar the Astronomer and the Poet. We do not know a great deal about him as a person. We do know that as a young man he met the mysterious teacher or adept or sorcerer, however you wish to regard him, who was later to become the head of the secret fraternity of the Hassani. He is said, Umar is said, to have been a blood brother of Ibn Saba, the mad magician of Mount Almond. He is said to have studied the secret teachings of the Holy House of Cairo, where there was a university of magical arts, of mystical teachings and beliefs. Here disciples seated on the marble pavement of a Muslim mosque were reading Aristotle and Plato and studying the abstract musical theories of Pythagoras, all under the broad banner of Islam, and all dedicated to the advancement of the religion of the prophet. Omar left behind him a considerable mass of poetry. The part we are most familiar with is called the Rubaiyat, but the majority of those who have enjoyed it have actually never read the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. They have read what has been somewhat facetiously referred to as the Rubaiyat of Edward Fitzgerald's interpretation. I got that one twisted around my tongue. But Fitzgerald's Rubaiyat is really not the work at all. It is really only a paraphrasing of certain elements of the Rubaiyat. There is no verse in Fitzgerald that agrees really with a single verse of Omar's poem. But altogether, Fitzgerald captured the spirit of the poem. He perhaps did a better job than Omar, because he took the very soul of a very lengthy and overwritten original and reduced it to a rather compact form which conveys the strange pessimism of Omar, the strange mysticism which underlies all of his poems. Fitzgerald also captures the mysterious structure of the quatrains, one of the most interesting and dramatic forms of poetic writing, peculiarly suitable to Sufi poetry. In bringing together the elements of Omar's philosophy, Fitzgerald was also aware of the curious pessimism which really distinguishes the work. So we have to try to understand this pessimism a little better. About 50 or 75 years ago, the Rubaiyat became a very favorite book among English-speaking people. Through Fitzgerald's translation, it fitted into the mood of a transition period in Western man's way of life. In the years around World War I, even as far as the beginning of the Depression, men in the West were very uncertain in their thinking. Materialism and materialistic science, industry, had undermined man's faith. And this undermining, this nostalgia about the difficulty in believing, sort of fitted in with the mood of Omar, and Omar fitted in to the mood of a disillusioned generation of Western peoples. For a time, the Rubaiyat was on almost everyone's library table. It was much discussed and almost constantly read. Everyone felt a little sad and weary after reading it, and this was considered almost a good sign. It had something to do with the disillusionment of the time. Because it was read very largely by individuals in an intellectual predicament, it is only natural that they should have approached it pessimistically and interpreted it negatively. A negative attitude in the reader would certainly justify assuming that Omar was a pretty badly disillusioned man. But let's study the general undercurrent of the poem more carefully. Perhaps some will say that Omar was a fatalist, which is more or less a Muslim characteristic. To the Muslim, there is an inevitable. Everything is predestined and foreordained. The individual marching along the road is going where it was intended that he should go long before he was born. The place where a man meets death was predestined. Even as late as the World War II period, Muslim troops were almost completely fatalistic. To them, they lived in a universe of unchangeable destinies. And some recording angel, some mysterious power in heaven, had their destiny in a book or on a scroll and from this writing there could be no escape. Omar seems to suggest this kind of thinking. Perhaps, however, what Omar is really thinking about is much the same that we find in the philosophy of Buddha. To Buddha, this world was a strangely pessimistic sphere. Yet out of Buddhism came a great idealistic philosophy, and the same happened essentially in Arabia. The pessimism of Omar, like the pessimism of Buddha, is based upon an insight into the differences between reality and the conditions of illusion in which we live. To Omar, this world and all that it contained was a kind of dreaming, a world in which nothing was very important and never could be. There was a revulsion in him against the materialism and rather sensuous background of Arabian life. He sensed the futility of everything. Buddha also sensed this universal futility. But in some way, he was able to leave a more positive attitude among those who studied his work. Perhaps Omar did not wish to leave this positive attitude. He wished to point out that the existence that we know is an utter, complete, inevitable futility. He gathered some of this pessimism perhaps from the old Orthodox Jewish beliefs, some from the terrible fears that were raging through Christendom at that time. In the days of Omar, Christendom was living in a state of continuous terror, for Christendom was convinced that the world was about to end and all men would perish together for their sins. It was a time of sin and negation. It was everywhere in the air because men felt they deserved it. Perhaps this is again why we have strange moral doubts and uncertainties stirring in our consciousness today. There is an uneasiness in us, rooted essentially in the realization of our own shortcomings. If we carefully study Omar, however, we see that what he is actually telling us is that the procedures, the courses of life to which we have become addicted are meaningless. And with the true insight of the Sufi, who incidentally is paralleled in Europe by another group in the Christian world called the Ignorantine Friars, that all material knowledge is absolute vanity. This, of course, is an extreme point of view, but it arose in a time of extremes. Yet perhaps somewhere in this rather exaggerated attitude, there is a considerable amount of basic truth. Most reformers overdo it a little, and Omar was no exception to the general rule. In an effort to drive home his point, he presented perhaps a more doleful picture than was absolutely necessary. But it is not correct, even in studying the Fitzgerald translation, to come to the conclusion that there is no relief or contrast in the Rubaiyat. It is not all negative. It is a curious mingling and mixture of disillusionment and abstract idealism. It tells us not only the futility of existence, but also, strangely and mysteriously, invites us into another kind of existence which is not futile. This is probably the strength of the entire document as a larger poem, as it was originally written by Omar, and the more condensed version in the English translation. In this poem, Omar makes use of a series of symbols. He has a very interesting play upon words, double meanings. He did not invent these double meanings, but they were current in the mystical literature of his time, and we find them arising again in Europe when the troubadours, bringing back Islamic mysticism, gave us the cycle of the Grail legends and later the great structure that Wagner was to use in the preparation of his Parsifal and Lohengrin. This mysterious double use of word meanings. And if we study the Rubaiyat, we shall understand that actually it is an invitation to a mystical experience. The poem, as it is abridged and condensed by Fitzgerald, makes this far more obvious than in the longer writing, where the arrangement is less fortunate of the various quatrains. We also find the same mass of implication and symbolism in the Arabian Nights Entertainment. And of course, it is everywhere throughout the poetic writings of Jalal ad-Din Rumi, the Masnavi. Always words used for a secret meaning, to imply far more than is to be found in the text itself. Many morose persons, or some who have other attitudes, have decided that Omar must have been the great inebriate of history. He seemed to have no interest in life except in becoming intoxicated. On the slightest provocation, he admits beyond question that he was never deep in anything but wine. No matter what happens, he invites everyone to drink themselves into forgetfulness. Now, whether this has contributed to the acute alcoholism of the present generation, we do not know, but this was certainly not his original meaning. The Sufis before him and after him, and many other of the mystical sects of the area, knew perfectly well that Omar's wine was no different from the Eucharist of the Church. Wine was the symbol among ancient peoples of the release of the internal psychic nature. They realized, of course, that the individual, under the stimulation of wine, might have extrasensory experiences. We are told in the early days that it was even recorded that the communion cup of the church was drugged in order to produce trances. Now, however we want to feel about that, the main point is, as we mentioned last week, that Omar's wine is the wine of ecstasy. It is the mystical experience. It is the transformation of life by a strange enthusiasm or in-godness. The mystic picked up into ecstasy is drunk with God. And even some of the most prosaic saints of Christendom have admitted the parallel. Namely, that it was almost as though they had actually been carried into ecstasy by the communion cup itself. Consequently, Omar points out through all of his apparently alcoholic reverie that what he really is trying to tell us is that when living conditions, world affairs, problems arise, we cannot really solve them by our fears, by our worries, by our rationalizations, by any of these processes with which we are commonly familiar. The only way, according to the Rubaiyat, finally, to dissolve all problems is to fall in love with God. In the moment of emergency, to suddenly align oneself with the eternal, to sense one's inner life picked up by a supreme adoration for the divine power and a complete admiration for the wonders of the universe. if man is so entirely aware of God that the love of God fills every part of his nature, so that there is no longer any place where this love of God is not apparent to him, he must at the same time be aware of this divine presence, not only in the friend but in the foe, not only in the mysteries of life but in the mysteries of death, that everything that exists exists within the ecstasy of God. Atoms dancing in the sunbeam, every bit of life moving, like even the electrons forever vibrating on their little polar axes. Everything alive with the presence of God. To know this, to be picked up by it, to lose oneself completely in it, is to be called one of the God-intoxicated saints. We know that this is not very different in essence and substance from the mystical experiences observed in the life of Sri Ramakrishna, the great Vedantic saint. It is said that he passed into a state of ecstasy so easily that all of a sudden a great and beautiful expression came over his face and he lost consciousness in the tremendous internal experience of the immediate presence of the Divine Mother. This losing oneself, becoming completely powerless in the grasp of the infinite, this type of thing has always been close to the Eastern soul, whether it was the soul of Lao Tzu or Buddha or the Vedantic saints or Patanjali. Whoever wrote of these things in the East writes of this strange experience in which the individual suddenly ceases to have any ordinary function as we know it, suddenly loses himself in a condition in which he is utterly incapable of self-control because he is God-controlled. He has no longer any desire to be a self, to have his own attitudes or his own convictions. He wishes only to be that. He wishes only to be united with the spirit of infinite life itself. Looking out into the universe, he does not see it as a place of planets and elements. He does not think of it in terms of space conquest. Rather, to him, the universe is suddenly transformed into the embracing power of infinite love. Everything is transformed into love rather than into wisdom. Everything outpours with divine grace, with infinite mercy. Even Havelock Ellis, in describing his mystical experience in the dance of life, comes very much to the same conclusion. Suddenly, nothing is important that used to be important. Suddenly, there can be no doubt about things that we once questioned. The problem of wealth and poverty, of friendship and animosity, things of this nature simply fade into nothingness. For all opposites, all contrived conditions produced by man himself cease in the infinite presence of the deity. This attitude perhaps opens the entire concept of the Rubaiyat. For the first words in the Fitzgerald translation, they simply begin with the thought, awake. It is as though we are asked to suddenly come into a different kind of a world. We are told that the sun has scattered into flight the stars before it on the plains of night. We are given the symbolism of dawn. And in this first great moment of dawn, the sun strikes the Sultan's palace with a shaft of light. The Sultan's palace or turret or tower or mosque always has the same meaning. It represents the human mind. It represents man. Man is the Sultan. His palace is his body. The dome of his palace or his minaret is always his mind. And therefore, in awaking, the coming of the spiritual dawn is when the light strikes the consciousness, the mind, that which is within the body, that which is the symbol of the Sultan's abode. For the Sultan is self-will, the person, the ego, the false personality of Buddhism and Taoism. But this must be struck with light. And this light must come from the mystery of the sun. And everywhere in the religions of the world, the sun has come finally to be identified with the illuminator. It is always the symbol of spiritual light. And to the points of Islam, the light of the sun became the proper symbol of man's becoming aware of the reality of things. It was the opening up of the darkened mind to the truth of eternal light. It was the rescuing of the person from his doubts, from his uncertainties, from his arguments, from his discords, from his jealousies, his antagonisms, his prejudices, all of which belong to the dark world. But when the light of the eternal sun strikes the tower or turret with its shaft, the sleeping reality in man awakens. This is the beginning of the Rubaiyat message, that we must suddenly recognize the coming of the dawn. To the man of the desert, the dawn was very real and important. And as he watched it breaking across the sands and the mountains and the ragged rocks, he beheld the wonder of the world. For this dawn was the symbol of the dawning within man of the reality of himself. The rescuing of his consciousness from delusion and illusion. And in the common experience of the individual, how do we interpret this? I think all mystics are in common agreement. Behme, the German mystic, refers to this enlightenment as a lightning flash. St. Paul, in the mysterious occurrence on the road to Damascus, the Theophany, had no way of estimating why it happened. But all of the mystics have been in agreement that unworthy as they are, and it is part of mysticism itself, part of the humility of goodness, that those who are truly good are most aware of their own imperfections. By some power then that perhaps may be likened to grace, but may perhaps still more be attributed simply to the inevitable eternal love of God for its creation. That there comes a time in the life of every person who has wandered in darkness, who has perhaps sought with what faculties he possessed, but not too effectively, for a better way of life. Sometime comes the dawn. Suddenly the inner world begins to lighten within the person. An experience occurs in him. And this experience transforms the universe from within himself. This is an essential concept of mysticism. Everything is changed because man's own point of view is changed. Nothing remains the same because man is no longer the same. And in the story of the Rubaiyat, we find the first suggestion of the true meaning, in that the reader is invited to be aware of the transcendental significance of the whole poem. It is assumed that he is challenged to awaken. And when he awakens, what happens? According to Omar, whose degree of awakenness we do not know, but who might have had considerable insight if we are to judge by his poems, awaking produces two moods. One is the sudden realization of what is real, and the other is the sudden realization of what is unreal. We discover things that were so very important and very significant to us, and they no longer have any meaning at all. We learn the strange transitoriness of things. We realize how short is the span of human life, how melancholy it must be for those who have no light. We find, therefore, that everything that once held our attention and seemed real or purposeful suddenly becomes comparatively useless. But in the poem, as in Zen and in many other systems of mysticism, illumination is not simply exchanging an irrational concept for a rational one, in which suddenly we become wiser. This is not the essential concept in mysticism as it was understood in the Near East. We therefore do not start out on a new kind of life with a new polarization. We do not take on the world again with greater insight and continue to struggle with all the old problems, simply approaching them a little more wisely. This was not the mystic point of view. This is the philosophical approach. And for many, it is the best road. But this is not Omar's concept. To Omar, when the individual gives up the old way, there is nothing left except the beloved. There is no longer any real reason to do things any better than we did them before, because they have no meaning anyway. What difference does it make whether we please our neighbor or we do not please our neighbor, if both ourselves and our neighbor will vanish away? This does not mean that we should be indifferent of others, far from it. It does not mean, therefore, that we should settle down to a calculated indifference to the requirements of other people. What it really means is that whatever we do after we have once seen reality, we do it only for other people, inasmuch as our own internal adjustment no longer requires that we be understood, only that we understand. This is the beginning of the Bodhisattva doctrine of the Mahayana Buddhist. The Bodhisattva is simply the individual who, by evolution, has reached the point where the world is no longer meaningful to him. He stands at the threshold of the Parinibbana. He can go on to the infinite. But it is the obligation or vow of the Bodhisattva that he will not go on to the infinite rest as long as suffering remains in the world. So he turns back to help this suffering, not because the world can do anything for him or to him, but because there is so much that he can do for the world. He can never be captured again in any illusion. He can never be held fast in any false doctrine. But he is capable, through the quietude of inner insight, to make a certain contribution to the evolution of the universe around him. This, again, is the Sufi point of view. Once the illumination comes, man no longer needs the world, but it still may be that the world needs him. But whatever he does with the full realization that he is not captured, he is not involved, he is not entwined in this complicated situation. He serves only one principle, and that is the principle of infinite good itself. It is not necessary for him to make any further compromise in his own character. Thus he is in this world, but not of it. He wanders along the road, but he is far away. Even though, however, he be far away, he is always near, because he has become more and more like the love of God, which surpasseth understanding. Like the infinite insight which he has begun to experience in himself, he is becoming omniscient and omnipresent. He can be in many places, in many conditions at one time, simply because the love of God can be everywhere, always. It is hard to put these thoughts into concrete expression, simply because they are an internal state. As far as the world can tell, this person may not have greatly altered, except that inwardly there is a new insight. There is a new depth of consciousness which has not been apparent before. This new depth of consciousness is the thing that reveals the Muslim saint.